Hello, I'm Alex Wisser. I'm a member of Kando School of Cultural Adaptation, and this is Groundswell. You're about to hear author Charles Massey deliver his keynote lecture, which he titled Why Regeneration, at the 2019 Pulse of the Earth Festival. Charles talks about his journey from industrial farmer to becoming one of the world's foremost proponents of regenerative agriculture. This event was held at the Living Classroom in Bingar, New South Wales. The live sound engineer for this session was Matthew McRae from McSound Electronics in Urala.
I now have this very honoured task of introducing Charlie Massey. I think a lot of you are familiar with Charlie. He's one of our wise elders. And I think I heard recently a very intelligent person say that with all our scientific advances and our technologies, we've accelerated our society into so many new directions, but we don't yet have the wisdom to manage what we've created. And I think when we hear people like Charlie speak, we know that we have some very wise people, and if their words actually can impact a wider population, we can get somewhere. And so Charlie took over the family farm, was at 22, and he ran a merino stud for 40 years. And through his lifetime, he's been engaged with agriculture in both as a farmer and then in a number of senior roles connected to the CSIRO, connected to the wool industry, the fibre industry, working even molecular biology and various developments both in the scientific area of agriculture and in acknowledging the phenomenal history of, for example, the sheep and wool industry. And through that process, over those years, he gradually became more and more engaged with regenerative agriculture. And as a writer and a thinker, he's been able to, in this book, which I hope some of you have come across, The Call of the Reed Warbler, A New Agriculture, A New Earth. And we have books down at the administration tent. And do we know when Charlie's doing a signing? Not yet. Charlie's been able to weave through the stories of farmers who have made significant changes in their practices. He's woven those stories with the science and with the human dimension. And I think it's just a wonderful example of that cultural story that I was saying before, that any change in the land, as scientific and as technical as it might be, as abstract as it might be, is a story of human change. And every ecological story is a human story and a cultural story. And I hope we'll get to hear some of this now. So can you please join with me and welcome Charles Massey.
Thanks very much, Laura. I'll have to put you on commission for selling a few books after that. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And thanks to Adam for your introduction, and particularly Kelvin for his words. 60 millennia of caring and managing country is a great lesson to us all when you look at what was happening yesterday as we flew in a dust storm. So we've got a lot to learn from all that experience. John's just left, but thanks, John, for his words. I wish there was a few more involved in politics with that sort of thinking. And Gary's words about change. That's really what this is all about as we go into probably the greatest challenge that our species and planet has ever faced. I think the story I'd like to tell today, and it's quite visual and hopefully a bit artistic, which is why Laura was flexible in moving up here. The story I want to tell today is about hope. The solutions are there. We're starting to learn how to make change. We just have to accelerate that enormously. So my message is very simple, if you can see it. If we regenerate healthy landscapes and soils, and we're going to hear a lot about soils because that's really the basis of a lot of it, from that comes healthy food and fibre. And yes, healthy profits, healthy people, and as we'll discuss later, a healthy planet. Sounds big claims? but it's absolutely true, and we've got the evidence for it. So regenerative agriculture, when I talk about that, I usually emphasise a hyphen between agri and culture, because it's all about that square foot of real estate and change. It's an agriculture that enables landscapes and systems to self-organise themselves back to health, to self-heal. Because over millions of years of co-evolution, the solutions to regeneration lie within the landscape and the biology, etc. And that's a radical concept for us farmers that want to control and dictate natural systems. So I'll start with a big context. I don't know if you can see those rats. They're discovering that they lie within the belly of the snake. In colloquial terms, as a species and a planet, we are in deep shit. Because it's undeniable now, where I'm still attached as a visiting lecturer at the Australian National University, some of the leading Earth system scientists, it's not just about climate. There's nine Earth systems that sustain our planet in a very delicate balance, and we humans have disturbed that. And there's an increasing consensus among scientists that we have now pushed our planet out of that last 12,000 odd years of stability that's known as the Holocene into a quite a dangerous new phase, which they are calling the Anthropocene, human-caused. And that's really what the big context behind us. So I think Gary mentioned earlier, there's only one of these, or it might have been Adam, there's only one blue-green planet, not just in the solar system, but wider. It's blue-green because it was life itself that created conditions for life on this planet. Most people don't realise that. About 3.2 billion years ago, it was bacteria first put oxygen up in the atmosphere. And over 400 million years ago, with trees and grasses, particularly trees at the start, the carbon dioxide cycle began to be regulated. So it's blue-green because of life, and now one species of that life, at the end of that long process of evolution, is now destabilising the health of this planet. It's a sobering thought. Why have we moved post-Second World War into this phase? It's a development called the Great Acceleration. When people started to look, scientists and others, social scientists, post-1960, they noticed almost every indicator, whether it was socioeconomic trends, you can't see it from there, population, real GDP, fertiliser consumption, paper production, water use, they all started to go up exponentially after the 1960s. It's human population rose as the economy rose. That's the orange stuff on the left. On the right, Earth system trends, same. Quite parallel, whether it's carbon or the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxides, etc. Ozone, temperature of the earth, surface temperature, acidity of the ocean, they all got that same exponential pattern. But there's one more. If you look at almost delayed by a few decades from the 1980s and 90s, the modern human diseases are doing the same thing. Doesn't matter if it's autism, ADHD, some of the cancers, obesity, same pattern, because they're all interconnected. And that's called the Great Acceleration. Are we a powerful species? Yes, we are. The RLC was the fourth largest freshwater lake or sea in the world. Soviet Union cotton, irrigation for cotton, completely drained it. It's exactly the same size as Tasmania. So we are a powerful species, is the message. And what we're doing, we are overloading our systems, in very simple terms. So I'm not going to go into the details, but that diagram on the left shows the nine key interconnected Earth systems that sustain our Holocene living conditions on Earth. Climate change is obviously one of them. Biodiversity is another. We're currently in the midst, and it's accelerating, of the sixth greatest extinction event this Earth has ever witnessed. The difference this time is that we've caused it, and it's accelerating. If you look what's happening in the Amazon, land clearing, et cetera, et cetera. And other there's land system change, freshwater use, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the research and the data, what emerges is one of the major causal factors of this destabilization, if not the key causal factor, is the worst forms of industrial agriculture. Not in every case, but certainly there, and sometimes it is the major case. There's a flip side to that, which I see as grounds for hope, which is an agriculture that instead of trying to dominate, simplify, poison, etc., turns around to enable nature to self-heal and self-organise. In other words, regenerative agriculture. We now know it is doable and it is profitable and far more resilient. So that's really the key that I want to get through. And so how do we get into that belly of the snake? And you see I've put the hyphen there between agri and culture because it is all about that square foot of real estate. So our Western agriculture evolved around about 10, 12,000 years ago in that area of the Middle East called the Fertile Crescent, Syria, Iran, around that part of the Mediterranean. And so about 10 or 11,000 years ago, the first sheep and goats were domesticated, then came cows. Roughly the same time, those little weedy plants that are now our modern cereals were domesticated. And they all came off healthy, spongy, fertile grasslands, incredibly diverse. And same with the river valleys where they began to irrigate, the Nile, Euphrates. And most of the Mediterranean was forested. But we know within 2,000 years that process of degradation had begun. You look at the Fertile Crescent today, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Libya, or the top end of the Sahara, beneath the Sahara, the Sahel, countries like Chad. They're all deserts, generally in constant drought and incredibly social conflict. That's the result of an inappropriate agriculture applied to sensitive landscapes. And you would have all heard, I'm sure, after the Dust Bowl of America. And don't worry, we had our own dust bowls, we just don't talk about them. But President Roosevelt, when he's forming that conservation law, said that a nation that destroys its soils destroys itself. So if you look at that 10, 11,000 year history of agriculture around the world, we have nearly degraded 40% of all land suitable for agriculture. And it's still going, and yesterday's dust emphasises that story. I'll just quickly just talk about the last 2 months, July and August. Big heat wave in Europe. I was over there at the time. A lot of places never experienced anything like a 40 degree. They're getting it. You can see them bathing near the Eiffel Tower. We now know Amazonia is ablaze, let alone some of the Siberian country. And in one day, a couple of weeks ago, 12 billion tonnes of ice melted in Greenland, and it's still accelerating. If you look at the top left photo, if you can see it, at that heat, where's that heat that hit Europe come from? It's come from the northern Sahara and the Sahel, which is all desertified, and that's why the heat's moved up. We're not too good at looking after our soils here either, whether it's spraying and poisoning, particularly overgrazing, or applying industrial fertilisers that kills off the soil biology. We've been pretty good at it, and as I'll talk later, I've certainly done it myself. The point I'm trying to make is that there is another pathway. And the real key is we're going to hear, we've got some great soil scientists here today and tomorrow, and the point I want to make is that the key is really developing healthy, biologically active soils which drives all the landscape functions. So the simple message is that plants, and it's more and more emerging, we need animals in healthy rotation in both cropping and grazing systems. These can restore our farms and our soils and our ecosystems and profits. I'm not talking about monocultures of plants. Nature never works in monocultures. She works in complex diversity, biodiversity, which means that everything's contributing in a different way under the soil. Not talking about industrial inputs. I'm talking about things like multi-species cover crops, some of the new cropping efforts, and richly diverse grasslands, and in most cases, holistically grazed, as with, say, the big African herds, fast rotations, high density, and a lot of rest to stimulate that whole system. How do we turn it around? As I'll show you in my case, by developing ecological literacy. And by that I mean being able to read your landscape and how it works, which I certainly couldn't do when I had to start managing. You may not be able to see it, but that's a few years ago, a full page ad for Roundup. A white pointer attacking the soil. The Roundup drum's got a sexy face, sexy smile. And the language embedded in that ad has words like trust your killer instincts. It's not encouraging us to love Mother Earth. And those ads are formulated by psychologists working for the big end of town, so they know how to press our buttons. So I had to take over at 22, even though growing up on a farm doesn't mean you know how to manage it. And so I sought the best advice, which meant I became a good industrial farmer. I set stocked, had too many numbers, I fertilised, and towards the end of that part of my career I even sprayed. And I could walk past that landscape on the right, you may not see it, but it was once a healthy grassy woodland, it's now eroded. I could drive past that and not even realise it should have been in hospital in intensive care. I was that ecologically literate. So you may not be able to see it, but based on work of Alan Savory, but other landscape ecologists, etc., you can really simplify the basics of how landscapes function down to five key things. The solar system obviously drives everything with plants photosynthesizing sugars into the soil, etc. That impacts on the healthy soil biology, the soil mineral cycle, impacts on the water cycle, and then you've got the biodiversity or complex dynamic functions integrally involved. What's usually missed in the model are those little creatures down on the right. We're humans. How we manage, care, or don't manage the landscapes. And if you look at the arrows in that diagram, everything is interconnected between the five. If you damage one, you overgraze, say, and knock out your solar panels that are photosynthesizing, you're going to affect everything else because of that interconnection. And it's these five things that undergird our entire civilization. If we carry on and damage it, ploughing, nature's not designed to be ploughed or interfered with that delicate soil mechanism. If we overspray, over-fertilise or overgraze particularly, that's what happens to all those interconnections. They're all destroyed. And we're well down the track of starting to desertify. So I'm now going to whip through those cycles with some positive examples. I've sort of finished with a negative. We know about that, but we have to bear that in mind because that's our challenge. And so my simple approach as a landscape manager today, grazing, is basically I want to try and stack on as many solar panels, the green chloroplast, as I can on my landscape for as long as I can throughout the year to keep those sugars going into the soil to drive the whole system. And if it goes dry and hard, I certainly want to protect that soil with cover. So there's some remarkable examples. Gary McDowell was one of the senior guys and probably one of the leading regenerative ag organisations in Australia, Resource Consulting Services. It's nothing to have 2,000, 4,000 cows or more replicating those big African herds, if you like, but under human management. And believe it or not, has extraordinary transformative impact, which I'll show you some examples. This is in tough country in South Africa, the Karoo region. I stayed with this guy. Unfortunately, he's just died, Norman Kroon. But that fence line, if you can see it, on the right when he began farming in the late 70s, it was all desert. Had to walk a kilometre to find a perennial plant. And that was 400 years of Dutch and English mismanagement, desertified it. He then began ecological grazing, and within 3 years had tripled his water retention, and now his family are more than tripled their entire production with much greater resilience. It's quite transformative. You probably can't see that, but that's country up in the Pilbara, northwest of Western Australia. Again, incredibly dramatic shift. In this case, only 10 years, 11 years, from about 90% bare ground, highly degraded, to 100% ground cover, which absorbs those big rains in cyclones, etc. His production's gone from a few hundred cows, he's now got 2,500 cows grazing in 3 mobs. You can't put a dollar value on that. It's quite extraordinary when you get it right. And the same now is being applied and has been for a while in cropping, whether it's Colin Sizer's pasture cropping or no-kill cropping. It's where you use green material as part of your cropping cycle where you can, and the new development coming out of both America and Australia is multi-species cover cropping, where you plant, if you can, at least 13 different species doing different things, either to build your fertility for next year's crop, or if well managed, you can take a crop off at the end. But animals are integral into that system, in laying down the cover to protect the soil, to recycle the dung, and also the interaction with the microbes in their gut with the soil. Impact on the water cycle. This is shot in northern Mexico. Those blue arrows are the same, it's the same landscape where those blue arrows are. On the left, centuries of overgrazing. So that ground was rock hard. You get a big rain, it all runs off. That's why there's a big water at the bottom. 27 years later of holistic grazing on the right, no water visible, but 10,000 times more in ground and stocking and performance, you know, 3 or 4 times more. If you get it right and you start doing this and the soil biology starts to lock down longer lived carbon, you're starting to put more carbon in the soil. Glenn Morris is one of our soil experts who'll be talking later. He's one of many scientists who have done work here, and I'm quoting some of his master's work. It's just increased soil carbon by 1%, soil organic carbon. Those soils are capable of storing over another 140,000 extra litres of water per hectare, just because of that regenerative move. Sort of no-brainer stuff. When in this continent, water's our key limiting factor. The importance of having cover on your ground is pretty simple. I'll give you 2 examples. If we overgraze, leave crop fallow to the sun, etc., etc., you're on the path of desertification. For example, bare ground with splash erosion. Splash erosion on bare soil delivers more compaction than tillage and heavy vehicles. It's that violent. You may not be able to see it, but that's sort of a schematic diagram of the big croplands of Australia, North America, South America. Underneath that orange horizontal line, this is in the prairies, a whole range of different roots and depths due to the diversity of that prairie. We've now simplified that with ploughing and mainly annual shallow-rooted plants, our cereals. We now have a generic hard pan across tens of millions of hectares of the world's cropping because of that. No life underneath, no water storage. And so the lost water capacity is just enormous. You may not be able to see it too clear from the back, but a few years ago I took a back road across the head of the Liverpool Plains, arguably some of Australia's best soils. It was a dry season, 2011, I think, yep. And the previous night that had 8 mils of rain. I came through about 12 hours later and I just stopped because I saw water lying on these black soils. Hopped over the fence, which is just behind the railway line, and those soils were so thickly capped, so dead, from so much over-ploughing, over-fertilising, over-spraying, that 8 mils of rain that should have gone in 5 minutes, still lying there. I went for a drive up with the farmer I was interviewing, the head of the plains there, and he showed me an old track where the cattle grids were about a metre high, higher than the soil today. Australia's best soils. But there's an upside. I mean, we've all done that. Well, I certainly have. And this is one of the keys, and you're going to hear some great stuff over this weekend. An effective soil mineral cycle, which means biologically alive soils. I did university courses in soil nearly 40 years apart. I went back in the late 50s to do a PhD. I sat in on that soil course, and both courses, 40 years apart, mainly physics and chemistry. The number one issue, healthy biology, which determines the others anyway, was hardly mentioned. So it's fairly basic. Your soil microbes and other life require plants for food. They have a partnership with food, with the plants. The plants photosynthesize, release exudates and sugars, which feeds the biology, and the whole system gets driven. And our natural world, 93% of the non-plant organisms are microbes. We can't see them, so we don't react to them because we, certainly in my case, when I started farming, didn't know they were there. They're absolutely crucial. Just give you one example. So like I was farming, if I overgrazed or ploughed, you end up with plants like on the left. They don't have one of the really valuable critters in the soil, which are our soil mycorrhizae, the root fungus. When you do have root fungus, their partnership is they get the plant sugars and their part of the bargain is to go off and source in the nutrients and micronutrients. That's what gets into the plants, into our food, makes healthy humans. If you go and destroy them, like on the left, you don't have that. You end up with drug addict plants waiting for their industrial fix of NPK, etc. Ergo, human health issues. In a healthy cubic metre of soil, you might have up to 25,000 kilometres of these micro-feeding tubes for the fungus, sourcing those nutrients. Go fertilise and plough, you get rid of all that. Sort of no-brainer stuff, isn't it? Just another example of why our soil is so precious and why we need to cover it. I'm talking about 41 degree air temperature here on fallow soils that I see every summer from Western Australia right across to the east. So 41 degree temperatures and higher is now coming. Not only are you getting a huge evaporation loss, but if you get down about half a centimetre, that 41 degrees goes to over 60 because there's a baking effect. Kills off all your biology. No one likes over 60 degrees, or very few. The flip side was there is now some extraordinary cropping developments. This couple, I haven't got time to give you some of the big breakthroughs. This couple in Western Australia, the last 10 years while the Western Australian wheat belt's gone into enormous debt, they've grown their business from 600 hectares to 18,000. Eliminated industrial inputs. So when they now plant their cereals and canolas, they're wrapping vermijuice, worm juice and compost extract around the seed as they plant. And that's what's driving their system. They've now eliminated over 90% of their costs. They're getting yields equivalent or better to neighbours. And they're grazing it with sheep, which is part of the integral part of the system. So they're stacking in extra enterprises. It's incredibly exciting what's going on. And that's many examples of different techniques around the world we can't cover today. But when you go out into that, what's really beach sand, 3.8 billion year old soils in Western Australia, they get the biology going, you end up with soils like this. Extraordinary structure and aggregation. That little sticky stuff there is glomalin. And that's what our soils should look like. Very few do. And a great soil scientist we work with, Walter Yainer, used to be with CSIRO, he uses the wonderful metaphor that our soils should look like cathedrals. A good soil has about 50% air pockets, which is where the water's stored. But if you look at that interior of the cathedral there, it's also where all the exchange of nutrients, your important cations, etc., occurs. And it's where things like protection from disease occurs in that interaction. In other words, healthy soil has selective, intelligent interfaces, along with that beautiful aggregated structure. It's a bombed-out cathedral in the Second World War. That's what our agriculture does. That's poor landscape management. We're destroying our cathedrals, soil cathedrals. Just quickly, another example of what's now developing in both the American cropping belt and working closely with Australia's. There's a lot of collaboration going on. Multi-species cover cropping, where you use diversity species to build your soil biology and put cover down. Just to show you how impactful it is, Gabe Brown, this innovator, in 12 years, he turned his soil from that solid clump on top of the shovel to that aggregated, worm-filled soil underneath. It stores 10 times more water. I mean, if you took a penetrometer to those soils, I reckon his would be about 100 psi. The clod on top, which is his industrial neighbour, only 40 metres through the fence, would be about 1,000 psi if you didn't break your penetrometer. It's just black and white, no-brainer stuff when it's well applied. So the simple message is that healthy grasslands and grazed croplands are like liquid carbon pumps. They're putting carbon into the soil, which is that soil organic carbon, and that's what's driving our profitability and our resilience. And as a manager, in my early days, I didn't have a bloody clue, and so I was upending that whole wonderful process. We haven't got time to cover this, but I don't want to belittle it. If you get all the other functions working, you end up with wonderful biodiversity in your pastures, your grass, your shrubs. You've got your insect, bird control for pests and all the rest of it. So just to sort of wrap up some of the big points, how does this relate to our big global issue of the Anthropocene challenge? And my answer is regenerative agriculture has, in my view, some of, if not the best solutions to the Anthropocene challenge. And I'll just give you one example. Some of you would have heard of Paul Hawken, Californian who for 30, 40 years has been doing wonderful work in social and environmental regeneration. He started off covering Martin Luther King's bridge march, so he was sensitized to social and environmental issues. And he got sick of asking climate scientists, what do we do about it? And most of them said, I don't know, we're crunching the numbers on gases, etc. So he initiated 100 scientists and analysts to come up with 100 best methods to pull carbon dioxide down, just one of our planetary systems. Published this book, Drawdown, beautiful book. And I've got to know him and I'm working with him. He's now working on the next part of this, which is going to be bigger, and it's called regeneration. And agriculture is going to have a huge part of that. But I said to him, in the top 20, there's four or five regenerative ag methods you've got the numbers on. They're all doing the same thing. Let's call them one. What are the numbers telling us? Regenerative agriculture is number one by nearly 2.5 times the next best method of pulling carbon down and squirreling it away. And that's without addressing water and the other issues. That's the exciting potential of us regenerating our landscape functions. And this is the other one that worries me. I've now got grandchildren. I see a whole generation now captured by this bloody stuff. We don't kick them out to play. They get in front of screens. And how are we going to get that next generation, whose problem we've caused the problems for them, to turn it around? That's the big challenge. And what is happening here today with the living classroom and other things is one of the exciting developments in addressing that. And most of these segments I'm talking about, you could do a day lecture on each of them. I'm only going to touch very briefly on the implications for human health, which comes from bad agriculture, because they're profound. That's the parallel rises of human ill health with a decade or two behind the other great acceleration factors. I've put in a red line there, which parallels it. That's the rise of the use of glyphosate, Roundup, in the industrial world. I'm not saying it's one-on-one, it's multifactorial, but isn't it interesting? Those curves are incredibly parallel. So why is our healthy nutrients and micronutrients and minerals crashing from our food? We know the big processors are processing the crap out of it, so it'll last on a shelf for over a year. We know genetic modification. I've worked with a chair of the company, Molecular Geneticists. You do not go in and interfere complex, long-evolved gene mechanisms without negative consequences. There's almost no exception. You do not fiddle with that long co-evolved stuff. We know industrial chemicals and fertilizers are killing the very thing that makes healthy soils, healthy food, healthy humans, and that's the soil biology. But most of the decline in nutrients is related to a serious decline in soil health and soil carbon, which delivers nutrient-poor foods. It's sort of no-brainer stuff. And that's where we're going. Sad to say, and I could put a symbol on that milkshake container if I wanted to, but I won't. And look, I'm not here to abuse anyone using traditional methods. I've been there. It's a paradigm that's very powerful, and it works to a degree. But we're now finding out it has long-term consequences that have been unforeseen. And one of them is destroying food nutrient availability by killing the soil biology. The evidence on our industrial foods now having glyphosate right through them is mounting by the minute. And we now know it's having huge impact on our gut microbiome, and that those curves I showed you on all the modern diseases is closely related to it. I've been working with a guy called Zach Bush, a specialist in autism, who's now getting right into this, a big American doctor with lots of PhDs and scientists. And by the minute, the evidence on glyphosate, not just from him, but lots of scientists, which has been repressed, is frightening and it's mounting very quickly. So that's the elephant in the room. People don't want to talk about it for obvious reasons, from we don't know how to replace it yet. I mean, even though the knowledge resides within regenerative ag and the big end of town is so powerful, they can't envisage life without it. So wrapping up, it comes down to our choice. I'm arguing that regenerative agriculture is profitable and at the same time it helps save the planet and ourselves. Or we can carry on clearing the Amazon, leaving our soils bare, overgrazing, and basically roll the loaded dice. And as Hippocrates said, the guy that founded the modern health ethic, allegedly said nearly 2,500 years ago, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And you're only going to get good medicine in food off healthy soils. So I'll quickly wrap up. As a leading environmental writer, Gus Best said, today's problems can't be solved with today's mind. In other words, we've got to change our mindscapes before we can change our landscapes. There was an old farmer said to me the other day, the thinking that got us in the shit won't get us out of it. So our role as landscape managers, I repeat, in regenerative agriculture is to enable all those functions to return to health, nature's wisdom to self-organise. And that's because that's the big engine that drives regeneration and landscape health. It's that self-organisation, self-healing that's inherent, if we allow it. So regenerative agriculture, yes, profound solutions for challenging times. We can heal natural systems. We've got key solutions to the Anthropocene crisis. I don't see many others coming. And we've got key solutions to the human health crisis. It's one hell of a trifecta. Can we profitably, regeneratively graze and farm without industrial chemicals? Yes. Tens of millions of hectares are already doing it. In partnership with our urban cousins and their demand for healthy food, urban gardens, green cities, can we do it? Yes, it's happening worldwide. And this community is emphasising that, this living classroom, etc. Can we reconnect children with nature? Yes, it's happening, but we've bloody got to get going fast. Those kids bottom right, covered in mud. Children need, at an early age, to get out and ingest dirt to stimulate the microbiome and its defence systems. All our physical systems, if you talk to the evolutionary biologists. They need to be challenged. Kids need to have long sight to develop. They need to look out to develop long sight instead of, 80% of them, that age group having glasses. They need to run and jump to develop long bones, and they particularly need to ingest so-called germs to stimulate the immune system in our key microbiome. So I'll just finish with this story. What I'm arguing is we need a new story for our times. We are made for story. We're a story-loving species. And as I'll be discussing tomorrow, the current story we've got as a civilization, the story of growth and economic rationalism, is destructive. Yeah. It's suicidal. And as Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, the German thinker who Hitler had executed second last day of the war, the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. So I'll leave it there, and I don't know if you want questions, Adam, but thanks very much.